Sitara.
Wow.
I would like to have a word.
Oh, and the word is showtime.
But not right now.
Holy cow.
Not right now. We'll have a word after right the show about the song that you put in my head. Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We made it through Election Day, mostly. Some hangovers have been reported on Twitter. While we know a little more than today than we did. We know more today than we did last night. That is not saying a ton, because the counting continues.
The counting continues. The lawsuits have been filed. The counting is being told to stop. Victory is being claimed. All kinds of stuff is happening. It's all kind of bananas.
Bleep, bloop, blark.
We're going to take you away from most of that today. It is, of course, What Do You Want on a Wednesday? Some listener questions, some election-related, some not. And there you go. That's the deal.
Yeah. Which we thought, I honestly, I've never been more grateful for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. So let's roll on in. Our first question is actually something I was wondering about just yesterday.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Stephen calling from New Jersey. As I'm sitting here on election day, virtual schooling my kids, trying to get work done, I'm just not being very productive. I was wondering if there's any data to support making Election Day a holiday. I mean, I think it should for Democratic reasons, but is there any evidence that would make business leaders want to support it as well by showing that it is actually less productive?
Well, it's a good one.
That would be awesome. I can tell you that my son's classes were canceled today. His one, like,
really?
I'm like, really? You canceled this one class. They only have one class on Wednesday. And they canceled it. And I'm like, that must be lovely. Anyway, this is basically in the same category of as like March Madness, except for democracy. When it comes to worker productivity, it definitely does cost money. Estimates have been done that say that productivity losses from the election, basically between time off for voting and then the distractions of following coverage. And this was in 2018, could reach up to, wait for it, $3.5 billion per hour.
Yeah.
Per hour.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it definitely it costs business and less productivity. However, when you give people a day off, you have to give them paid time off. You have to like figure out who has to work and who doesn't. Like on those 3-day weekends, it used to be about honoring somebody, but now we're about buying a sofa. But there is support.
Yeah, good point.
Growing.
Good point.
Yeah. Furniture sales, as my dad favorite, likes to say.
That's right. That's right. My favorite part of this is that public employees in some states, right, Kentucky, Michigan, New York are three of them, do have Election Day off already. But, says CBS News, thank you, Marissa Cabrera, for putting this in the prep, turnout is not noticeably higher in those states versus states where it's not a holiday. So I don't know that people would, to Molly's point, right? They might go couch shopping and not voting.
Right. You know? Well, and arguably based on like the way that we sound today, and I mean, my lack of focus today is far more intense than yesterday. So then it's like, do you do 2 days? Do you do the 3rd and the 4th? Or do you do the day after Election Day? Is that a holiday? Like, I don't really know.
Well, let's posit that not all elections, first of all, not all elections are presidential elections, right? Not all presidential elections will be as consequential as we have discussed on this podcast. This one has been. And also, I think it's really interesting that you were less productive today. I, after a very down day yesterday, as I said, I was on fire today. I was banging stuff out, getting it done, checking my Twitter, reading the news, boom, boom, doing stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know what
Yeah,
that,
no.
What
I mean, I got stuff done, but today my brain feels like spaghetti. Just absolute spaghetti. Like, I'm just like, I'm looking at this and I'm doing that and I'm looking over here and I'm texting my friends and then we're all calling each other and I don't know. Anyway, 65% of U.S. adults surveyed by Pew Research Center say they do favor making Election Day a federal holiday. I think if we did it, it's probably less of a financial argument because the productivity is not as much the argument. The argument really is, you know, the civic duty part of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yep. We'll see. I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right, where are we going next? Sorry, I got to get back to the right tab. All right, so another question that came off of Twitter, I think, Molly, and you were the one who saw this. Here's what Laura wants to know. Is there data or reporting that can tell me the correlation between fundraising and winning office? If I want my candidate to win, does it really help them if I donate to that campaign? So we did what we did a couple of weeks ago, was got Sheila Krumholtz from the Center for Responsive Politics on the phone. We talked to her about dark money. And we got her on to ask this question. Here's what she said.
Yes, typically there is a strong correlation between spending and winning in national politics, according to our research at Open Secrets. Cycle after cycle, typically more than 90% of House candidates that spend the most win. In the Senate, it's more volatile, and that's especially true this cycle. As in so many other ways, 2020 looks different. There are a lot of factors at play. The surge in small donors, who may be motivated more by emotion than strategy. Outside spending, so a candidate might spend less but be backed up by tens of millions spent on their behalf by outside groups. And of course, it still remains to be seen whether this holds true in 2020 because so many races have yet to be called. For that matter, for candidates that spent the most but still lost, it may be true that they would have lost by even more if they had not spent as much as they did. So we may see diminishing returns in 2020 as compared with previous years, but the correlation is still there, especially in the House.
That's so fascinating because the examples that I've seen today, we had this in the Make Me Smart Slack earlier today, were all Senate races, right? And the one that just really stands out, there are two that stand out. South Carolina, Jamie Harrison raises $110 million, loses to Lindsey Graham by 11 points. Amy McGrath raises $90 million, loses to Mitch McConnell in Kentucky by 20 points. So I get what she's saying about the Senate. And there are others where the ROI for Democrats was terrible. Here's the other thought, though, here's the other thought. I wonder if all that money going to Amy McGrath in a, let's be honest, hopeless race against Mitch McConnell sucked money from other races where maybe it could have done some good. I don't know.
Well, it was really interesting because the Princeton Election Consortium has this guy, Sam Wang, I think is his name, who basically created this, he called it the Moneyball approach to giving in this election, and basically said what you just said, which is that there are certain states where it does not matter. You can give all the money you want to Mitch McConnell's opponent or even Lindsey Graham's opponent, but the truth is it's not just politics, it's gerrymandering. Like, these states have been essentially divided up in a way that is going to ensure that the incumbents win. And so they actually created a very interesting list that was like, there are some moneyball states where your money can do some good. Montana was one of them. Maine was another one. Alaska. And I think that down the road, because a lot of this money, what I find so fascinating is that so much of this money came through that Act Blue site, which was basically like the first time, from what I understand, really one of the first times that a true crowdfunding platform had been introduced into politics, and it processed $1.5 billion between July and September. And only later in the game, from what I could tell, did they start to kind of create pooled money. And they would say, like, we'll distribute it to these moneyball states or to states where we think it can do the most good. Because I think they did, a ton of money went into South Carolina and Kentucky when, you know, people like this Princeton Election Consortium guy were screaming into the rafters, like, this is a waste of money. So it is a really, it's a really different and interesting question.
Yeah, and that gerrymandering point goes to what Sheila was saying about House races, right? Because you can't gerrymander a Senate race because it's the whole state, but House races for sure are gerrymandered, and that's where I think her point is that money comes in most usefully. But anyway.
Oh, no, I think it was the opposite. I think it was like that some Senate districts are so gerrymandered,
You can't gerrymander a state. You can't gerrymander a state.
Hold on. Now I gotta look.
Okay.
I know it's the. I'm familiar with how voting for senators works.
I'm
looking for backup.
I just. Okay.
Give me a second. I'll have it by the end of the show. Okay.
All right. Okay.
We're going to, for obvious reasons, because nobody is happy when we talk about elections, including us. Going to take a break from talking about the election and get to one of the other questioners that listeners have been asking. Here is one from Richard in the Bay Area. Just in time for, I know you've forgotten that this is happening, Friday's October jobs report.
Oh, I know.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I have a question about how unemployment is measured. It's always struck me as strange that the unemployment level seems low when there seems like there's so many people unemployed. And then it occurred to me while listening to Marketplace the other day that what seems to be missing is that people that give up are no longer considered unemployed, which is really bizarre. Is there somewhere that actually measures the unemployment rate of how many people are employable in the United States versus employed?
Kinda. So, not to get too far down in the weeds, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics provides six measures of unemployment. They are called U1 through U6. The headline number that you get every month is the U3 number, right? It's total unemployed as a percent of the civilian labor force, right? Also called the unemployment rate for September, 7.9%. But a more complete measure is down at the bottom of that column called the U6, which is total unemployed plus all persons marginally attached to the labor force, plus total employed part-time for economic reasons as a percent of the civilian labor force, plus all persons marginally attached to the labor force. And that, I think, is the category that Richard maybe is thinking about. And let me give you the number. So remember, the overall headline number for September was 7.9% unemployment, still really, really high based on the past like decade or so. The U6, which is everybody, 12.8%, which is a much bigger chunk of the population. So does it get to everybody who's like, yeah, you know, I mean, I kind of want a job and I'm basically employable because I, you know, have skills and whatever, but meh. I don't know, but it gets a much bigger chunk of the population. So look for U6. Go to BLS.gov and then Google U6 and you can get there.
Nice. Also, you're totally right. What had confused me in my spaghetti brain, which I mentioned earlier, was that the Princeton Election Consortium project includes both Moneyball races and an anti-gerrymandering campaign.
There you go. There you go.
Yep,
and look,
yep.
Gerrymandering is a plague. I mean, it's
those
terrible.
Two things
it's,
got it's all hard. Mushed together. Yeah. Redistricting Moneyball. Yeah. So like in the same paragraph, they have like Moneyball states and redistricting Moneyball. And I confused myself and then yelled at Kai and I apologize.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Okay. Do we want to go on or is
there
anything
else? Wait, no, I have to go back to the thing. Do we have more? I was also in the wrong. Let's talk about the pandemic, actually. We have a backup, and it seems reasonable to mention that that's still happening, and that apparently today, for the first time here in the United States, we crossed 100,000 new cases. 100,000.
Oh, man. I missed that.
New cases. Yes. But this is not about that. This question comes from Brooke in New York.
Now, with everyone being remote because of the pandemic, is there any word on how tax filing is going to happen? What does the company do? And what do I do when I have to come to taxes at the end of the year 2020, which hopefully is coming sooner than later, right?
Wait, the end of 2020 is coming sooner rather than later? Well,
end of 2020
is coming on
sooner
time.
Later, right?
Neither sooner nor later. I just want it to come on time. How about that?
Time is relative.
So look, tax filing this year, it's going to be a mess for a lot of people who've like worked from home and decided that home doesn't have to be where their office is, but rather is going to be in like Iowa or Florida where there's no state income tax or what have you. I think it's going to be a total mess. Truly, I do.
I think so too. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, they delayed the tax filing deadline, obviously, this year in 2020. I honestly... This feels like a thing that is impossible to ask or is impossible to even approach, given where we are with uncertainty around what our federal government's going to look like. But it is fascinating. And also, there's a bunch of data in here from our producers about how many people are moving. This is a great Marketplace story. Yeah. The idea of like some people might have to pay taxes in two states. At least 13 states have agreed not to tax workers who relocated there, which seems kind of surprising. I mean, it's a good way to entice them, but my understanding is state revenues were down. So that's kind of interesting. And then, yeah, who
knows? Yeah, state revenues are down everywhere. I think after January 1st, that's when you're going to start seeing a lot of this information pop up about what you should do and who you should talk to and how it's going to play out, right? Because honestly, no one's thinking about that right now, given the state of the government and everything.
But this is an excellent vein for us to mine.
Yeah, for sure.
Too.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Although the problem is there's like a 11 zillion variables, right? So whoever we would get to would say, well, you should really consult your local experts.
It depends on where you live and the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Okay, true.
Yeah.
True. Okay. Right. Still, good question. Good questions from
great
everyone.
Question.
Thank
great
you.
Question. Great question. Hopefully some equally good answers, one hopes. And with that, we bring What Do You Want to Know Wednesday to a close. Fingers crossed we'll know more about this election the next time we meet, because if not, I don't even know if not. I don't even know.
This seems like a good time to mention that Bush-Gore in 2000 took 36 days to be resolved.
Yeah. Yep.
So put your expectations somewhere between tomorrow and 36 days, and you'll definitely be in the ballpark. And keep sending us your questions and comments to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We love the voice memos. It's so great to hear all your lovely, friendly voices. Thanks for sending them.
It's really good. Make Me Smart is produced, directed, and generally driven by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters. Make Me Smart skills on your smart devices. Erica, I did those for you today, by the way. Did I tell you that? I did. Okay. All right.
Good job.
I ordered
good
some
job.
Stuff.
Yeah. That made me panic because I was like, wait, do I have some to record? But I think maybe not till tomorrow. Okay, anyway, today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad, who is always sharp as a tack, unlike my spaghetti brain. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Donna Tam is a senior producer and the executive director of On Demand, who got a really annoying song in my head earlier today. It's Sitara Nieves.
There we go. Boom.
Boom, boom, boom. Boom. I'm exhausted.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.